welcome to Sherapy Sessions, Cutting Toxic Family Ties. My name is Dr. Sherry Campbell, and I'm your host. I am a leading expert in the niche of toxic family abuse, and although my show cannot substitute for therapy, it is a survivor-based show. In me, you're not only going to get an expert, but you're also going to get a survivor, as I have also survived toxic family abuse. I know how hard it is. The goal I have is to give voice to the voiceless, to provide skills to help you to protect your peace, to stand your solid ground, and to navigate and heal the heartbreaks caused by toxic family. Please have a pen and paper available to give voice to your thoughts as you listen to each show. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for your bravery. So let the healing begin. Welcome back, everyone, to Sherapy Sessions, Cutting Toxic Family Ties with your host, Dr. Sherry. And I am so excited about today. I am interviewing actually one of my favorite people in this community. And she found me, and I feel so lucky, Laura, that you did find me. And I'm a part of many of her summits. And her summit this year was huge. Many of my brave-hearted followers attended the summit, and it's really a life-changing summit. And so the reason I want Laura on today is, one, she's an expert in this field. Two, she's lived it. And I really only enjoy interviewing other survivors, because as survivors, we can really tell the difference. You know, Laura's agreeing here that someone who's studied it as compared to someone who's lived it is such a different experience. And I really want to showcase her book. It's called It's Not Your Fault. Could you imagine? The Subconscious Reasons We Self-Sabotage and How to Stop. And so I'm going to hold the book up. Please, everybody, go get this amazing book. I absolutely love the color. It's so approachable. It's warm. And the caps of the knot is really important, because we all feel like it's our fault. So I want to talk to Laura today about her experience in her family. I want her to tell us a little bit about who she is, but I want to dive into the concept of addictions and how it seems as survivors, we have all kinds of different things that we turn to for coping. And because I never turned to drugs or alcohol, I want to talk to Laura about that. And then I'll disclose a little bit about my eating disorder that I had, and that I still sort of have food as a friend of me. And I'm constantly having to work through that and when that gets triggered. And it feels very similar to an addiction to substances. So Laura, welcome to Sherapy Sessions.
Thank you, Sherry. Thank you so much for having me. And I too am so grateful that we came across each other's paths. And you've been so generous with me, with helping me promote and things like that. And I'm delighted that I got to endorse your book and how well your book is doing. I'm so excited about it because it's phenomenal. When I was reading it, I just thought, this is so helpful to people who need it. And it's because you have been through it and people can tell the difference. And in fact, that's like the number one thing my clients say to me makes the difference. It's not expertise. It's not education. It's the fact that I've been through it. And so I understand firsthand what they're going through.
I do feel as survivors, we just need a sense of community, because society does not support cutting ties. And I am the starter of the Cutting Ties with Family. And that's been an interesting thing to pioneer on my own, right? So now there's other people that are supporting that, you being one of them. And it's so different than cancel culture or any of these things. And thank you for endorsing my book. Like, what an honor to have another survivor endorse the book. And it is really exciting watching it fly and do what it did. And then my TED Talk dropped miraculously 4 days after my book, totally untimed. So wow, that was pretty incredible. Laura, tell my following a little bit about you and what you do and kind of what your purpose is and why you wrote your book.
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up in an extremely dysfunctional home. But like a lot of kids who grew up in toxic families, you don't really realize it until much later, because you just don't know any different. You don't know what's normal when all you know is the family that you're in. So I had a mother who was very emotionally abusive, and now I know that she was narcissistic and probably had another undiagnosed mental illness, like a borderline or something like that. And so she was just very mean to me, all the narcissistic mother things, like she thought I was an extension of her, no boundaries were allowed. She dictated what I wore, how I did my hair, what activities I did, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, not even considering saying no, that was just kind of brainwashed out of me that I even had the option to say no. I remember once she put me into some summer camp that I didn't want to be in. And my friend said, well, just tell her you don't want to do it. And I remember just thinking, you don't understand. Like, that's not an option. You know, it's just not.
I know, you get to that point, like, you can do that. Like, that was sort of like, wow, I didn't know that you could, people in other homes do that.
Right. Yeah. And not even sharing with my friend. And this is how we end up hiding and not being able to have true intimacy with people, because we're hiding what's going on. So I wouldn't say to this friend, I can't tell my mother that. I would just keep that to myself. And just know in my own mind that I can't do that. And then my father was very emotionally neglectful. And I didn't know until just a few years ago that childhood emotional neglect was actually a form of abuse. And he just basically ignored me. And if he ever did pay attention to me, it was just to criticize me. And it's interesting because I was a really smart kid and I was like top of my class. I skipped a grade. I won academic awards every year. And yet he really made me feel stupid. Like, he would kind of go out of his way to really make me feel stupid. Like, he would say, not you're stupid, but he would say, you know, that doesn't make you sound smart and things like that. Just kind of just knocking me down as much as he could. So that was just a little bit of the environment I was growing up in. I felt very alone. So fast forward to age 19, after growing up in this toxic soup, I'm looking for help on how to deal with the relationship with my mother, which is not working. And of course, I think that's all my fault. Mm-hmm. And going to a therapist, this is early 90s, so even prior to the ACEs study. Mm-hmm. So I go to the social worker and she does a whole intake on my family so she can see it's toxic. But then what she does is, for my problems, because the self-sabotage had started, the drinking had started and all of that, and I thought I was the problem, so I'm trying to figure myself out. And she gives me a book on positive psychology. I'm not against positive psychology, but that wasn't what I needed at the time. So I got the book Learned Optimism.
Oh my gosh.
And I got told basically the typical CBD, which is change your thoughts, mm-hmm. change your life. Mm-hmm. And not against that. There is a place for that. But where I was at the time, that wasn't the place. So I tried this Learned Optimism and I'm reading this book and thinking, this isn't working for me. Like, I thinking positively is not working for me. Mm-mm. And I could try, it just didn't work. And now I finally know that it's because logic is no match for trauma that's stored in the body, right? Like, it's just not, you can't talk yourself out of your trauma responses.
And also with cognitive behavioral therapy or positive psychology, it can unfortunately be used as gaslighting. Like, we learn to gaslight ourselves through that process, right? Like, if you have cancer, like, you know, in my book, I talk about, like, these parents are like a cancer. Cancer has its own course it's going to take. If you get into this, I'm going to think positive and it's going to heal my cancer, and then it doesn't, then you fault yourself because you had a day of thinking negative during your cancer journey. Like, it's the same emotional thing here, except cancer is far more acceptable to society than abusive parents. And so they can't be bad. It's you must change your thinking. And you're right. No amount of logic is going to go in and erase what happens to the body when there's trauma. And so you really weren't treated. You were, in my opinion, totally dismissed, even by the world of mental health.
Yeah. And gaslighting might be a good way to put it, too, even though it was well-intentioned.
Sure.
I would call it a form of gaslighting.
Yeah.
And so I continued on this journey of therapy, believing that was the way to get better. And I know I've talked to a lot of people, I think yourself included, that got good therapy, you know, mm-hmm. and it was really the beginning of their journey back to themselves and all of that. I didn't. It took me decades to find someone who could actually speak to what I was actually going through. And so I just went like from expert to expert trying to get help. And they would tell me, you know, instead of seeing what my mother really was, it's so obvious when I tell you the stories, they would say, you must have a relationship with your mother. You must. You will always regret not having a relationship with your parents. And Dr. Sherry, what I really regret is not cutting that off 10 years earlier.
You know, girl, you are preaching to the choir. You know, my first therapist at 16, she did see me, but I didn't have a choice but to still have a relationship with my mother because I was living with her. And back in my day, there was not really the labels. They were there. They were in the statistical manual of diagnostic behaviors, but people didn't just say your mom is narcissistic, your mom's borderline, your mom's histrionic, your mom's dependent, she's passive aggressive, she's got a little bit of APD. Like, no one really said that. It's like, you're not the problem, but your badness is a symptom of all the trauma, and I can't change your trauma, so we have to change you back to good. But I did at least feel seen by her. And then I went through, like you did, probably 7-8 therapists over the years. One called me too sensitive once, literally called me too sensitive. And I was like, you shouldn't have a license. First of all, under no circumstances should you ever tell any human being, especially if you are a licensed clinical psychologist, they are too sensitive. So it took me a long time to find the therapist I have now, because at 16, I was dependent. I needed food, home, and shelter. So she couldn't help me there, but she really did help me. And so it is important that, at least for me, and you did not get this, which breaks my heart, when I did go to a bad therapist, I knew. I'm like, oh, this one isn't going to work. And that could take you, just so the listeners know, it could take you 2 months of sessions to really figure that one out, especially coming from trauma, because we'll always make ourselves bad and try to see the good in what the therapist is doing, which then can keep us in a toxic relationship with a therapist, right? So I just think that, Laura, you and I choosing to speak out about this is a game changer for other people. I didn't leave till I was 45. Like, I really wish I would have left decades earlier, because I knew it was wrong, but I still thought it was me. So I feel like it's amazing how when we go look at a therapist in the face and we tell them something so grotesque, so egregious, they still go, I know, but it's your family. The title of my first book, right? But it's your mom. Like, and in my TED talk, I say a statement of, you better reconnect with your parents now. They're getting older, or you're going to feel guilty for the rest of your life. And it's like, but says who? Says who? Why is that a standard? They don't feel one bit guilty that they abuse the hell out of me. Like, why am I not allowed to feel relief that I don't have to continue to be abused? And it's such a societal trick, right? Mm-hmm. And so finding a good therapist is so hard. And so I'm just glad that you and I and other experts are putting our stories in the world. And one of my patients read your book, because she does struggle with addiction. So I have several questions for you about addiction, because I know there's like a genetic link. I know we're more genetically similar to our grandparents than our parents. Like, was addiction coming down through the genetics as well that predisposed you to drinking? Did you learn it? Were either of your parents drinkers? Did you just catch on to it? It's like, oh my God, I finally feel relief. Like, how would you explain how you got to that place?
My mother was definitely, I don't know if we even still call it alcoholic. I think they say alcohol use disorder now or something, but I just say alcoholic. Just
alcoholic.
Because that's what I'm used to.
Me too.
Yeah. My mother was definitely an untreated alcoholic, along with all, she had a sex addiction. Oh. I remember finding as a kid some really disgusting porn, like books and videos that she left in the VCR player.
Wow. Not yeah, protecting you at all.
No, she was probably drunk when she was watching it, you know. She used to brag about using, I'm from Canada, and we had something called a baby bonus, which is a just a check that you would get just for having a kid every month. And she would use that to buy, she said it was just enough to buy a bottle of gin. It was perfect.
Oh my God. You're like, oh good. I'm glad I'm your baby yeah. bonus. Yeah. I think alcohol use disorder is very minimizing when you've been raised under an alcoholic. You know, my dad was heavily into drugs, and his dad was such a heavy alcoholic that he actually drowned in his own vomit.
Oh my God.
He tripped over a fan and he fell back and he hit his head, and he was so intoxicated that he drowned. My dad came from a very difficult life. So he was heavily into drugs. Also, too much sex in my face. There's 9 marriages between 2 parents. My dad had sex on the floor in front of a bed my brother and I were sleeping in a studio apartment. And I was in 5th grade and he was in 8th grade. Like, we knew. They made it very obvious. So just no protection for your mom to be so intoxicated. She's just not protecting her child. You know, and then you're seeing all this stuff. So you saw all of that. What was your dad like? Was he at all addicted to anything?
Was kind of the opposite. Interestingly enough, my father did not drink. When they were younger, he drank mostly as a social thing because they were quite young parents. So he was a father in his mid-20s. And so when I was little, he was drinking and he would get very hungover and he would be in bed the whole day and throwing up and stuff. But as I got older, he just stopped drinking. But I don't believe he ever had alcoholism.
Sounds like his body didn't like alcohol.
Yeah,
like
it just exactly.
Rejected it.
Yeah.
So when you first drank, and is that your alcohol was what you turned to?
Yeah, alcohol was pretty much it. And I think it might have to do with my age because I'm a Generation X. I'm a little older than maybe some of the people watching. And so we didn't have all these drugs available to us that we have now. Crack wasn't even a thing, I don't know. So,
And weed,
alcohol was the drug of choice.
Yeah, you had to work real hard to get weed. I'm 53, so you had to work real hard. Like, it was like illegal. Yeah, I was not in touch. But my parents, I feel like, were hippies. And somehow they had it all. Like, they had LSD. I know my dad was like LSD by night, Quaaludes by day. I saw cocaine on tables. Like, I saw a lot. Like, he had sideburns, you know, like way down to here, and the red, white, and blue sunglasses. Like, he was very much into hotboxing his VW bus, like all the things. So, but the drugs today, it's nothing like how when you and I were raised at all. So when did you realize, like, oh my gosh, like, I have an addiction? And like, what did it make you feel? I wonder what you think about the concept of it being chronic comfort seeking.
Yeah, it was. So the first time I had a drink, I was probably about 16. And it was in my friend's basement. My friend was from England. Her parents were immigrants from England. And so they I don't know if this is the reason, but I think it was more of their culture to have a bar in the basement, like a stocked bar, and like snacks down there and everything. And so she made me a drink, and it was like half orange juice, half vodka, very strong. And I drank it, like, even just the first sip, I felt the first time my shoulders going down.
Oh.
I felt for the very first time comfort in my skin.
Wow.
I felt for the first time, like, wow, I am not consumed with hypervigilance. I can actually relax, you know? And so that was what was intoxicating, literally,
you know,
about
what?
Taking the drink.
But doesn't it make so much sense? When you grow up, I coin terms in my books, Laura, as you know, because they're just not in the DSM. And what's in the DSM often doesn't fit for a survivor of toxic parental abuse. But I coined a term called defensive hypervigilance trauma. Because we were always made wrong. So our shoulders are like, oh, my Lord. Or we're just walking through life like, I'm going to be wrong. Like, obviously, I'm going to be wrong. Apparently, in my life, there's a final exam around every corner, but I'm just not allowed to know what the test is on. So I'm going to be stupid. I'm going to be wrong. I'm going to be in the way. I'm going to need too much. I'm going to ask for too much. I'm going to talk back. Like, they need me to not exist. And so we get like this guardedness against the world. And it makes so much sense to me when you say that, like, the first time I had alcohol, I'm so afraid to vomit that I just get afraid of anything that will make me vomit. I'm very emetophobic, but I had peppermint schnapps in hot cocoa. And it was the first time I ever drank, and it made my body feel like super warm. And I could see how that feeling for someone like us could translate as, oh, I can breathe for a minute. Like, this whole weight of this trauma I'm carrying, like, all of a sudden I just feel instantly warm, and I feel instantly relaxed and a little more open and not so introverted, or some of those things. I could so see how it could make you feel that way.
Yeah, you really hit the nail on the head with what you said about the introversion too, because I felt like I could express myself. I could talk to people and not feel just completely inept, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I think a lot of us are introverts.
Yeah. I remember the first time I had that drink, feeling like I didn't want to go pee because I didn't want to lose the feeling, not knowing that's not how it works.
Wow.
Right? Yeah.
But you're so young, and it kind of makes sense that you'd be like, I just want to hold this. Like, I don't even want to get it out of my body. Oh.
I know. And so then, you know, every weekend I chase that feeling. And that's what they say in recovery rooms, is that you're looking for that first high, and you can never get back to it. And it's the consequences start piling up, you know?
Yeah.
That feeling is followed by, you know, bad things happen. You embarrass yourself, like, you get in trouble, you hurt yourself. Whatever happens, it just doesn't stop you. The consequences don't stop you. And you just go back to that short-term fix that gets you out of the pain that you're living with all the time.
Right? As a resident, I worked at the Salvation Army as like a senior supervising therapist over master's degree students, because I was in my doctorate. And Salvation Army takes addicts from anywhere, out of prison, off the streets, from good families. And it is really a great program. But I worked on the men's side. The women's side had just been built, but they were all from a very damaged place. And I was so surprised by how many of them were introverted. And one of the men said to me, I feel like I'm more myself when I'm drinking. When I'm not drinking, I'm shy, I'm guarded, I'm all these things. Like, he was just trying to extrovert himself, because he saw that as more likable or more interesting, or he could get more girls, you know, like he found himself to be far more charming. And he ended up dying of a stroke because he bottom just kept growing. Like, you know, the addiction just keeps growing, but he wasn't given comfort ever. You know, the first stage of life is trust versus mistrust. And if we do not have our basic needs met in that very first stage of life, it's very hard to go through any other stage successfully. The next stage is autonomy versus shame. Then it's like initiative versus guilt. And toxic parents, they don't want us, but they don't want us to separate from them either. And so it's like they consider normal developmentally healthy independence as anti-family. And you're just trying to grow. And we all seem to, in our teenage years, do something odd if we are from toxic parental abuse. My addiction, if you could call it that, was I starved myself. And this is where I'm thankful that I'm so terrified to throw up, because I really starved myself. And I was meticulous about slicing pieces of bread in half. I would measure every raisin if I ate. It ended up getting so bad that I lived on a jar of honey every week. And then my body was craving the sugar, and then it would crave salt. And then I would go get potato chips from the store, and I'd lick them, and I'd throw the food away. And then to hide it from my mom, I would take my food out in napkins and put it in my lap. But I do remember thinking weird thoughts like, I am juking her. Like, she doesn't even know I'm not eating. And I was so dissociated because I was so starved that I didn't even feel connected to my body. And that dissociation is what it felt like when you described your first drink of alcohol. I hated being in my body. I hated it because I had to be around her, or I had to be around my dad when an overweight woman would walk by and he'd go, look at that fat hog, literally. So that feeling of being out of my body or being dissociated, I felt like a balloon. I felt like I was above all of it. It, in a very distorted way, it made me feel stronger than my peers because I'd watch them eat lunch and I'd be like, I am so much stronger than them. And it saved my life in the sense that my worth, which is there was none clearly, but my idea of my worth now became dictated by my control. I was either a good girl and I ate zero fat grams, or I was a bad girl and I ate too many fat grams. I would count crackers. Like, it was insane, but it organized my life in some strange way, but it destroyed my body. And then when I was caught, I was humiliated. And my mom's response to me was, you have no idea how lucky you are that you can be fat. I can eat whatever I want and I don't ever gain weight. It's so hard to be so tiny like me. It's so twisted that she would say that to someone with an eating disorder. And so today, if I'm stressed, I lose appetite. So I have to be very careful of when I'm really stressed or I'm upset. I forget to eat. I get back into this weird dissociated sort of, I'm so consumed with my stress. And it still affects me today. I eat plenty, but everything that goes in my food, I'm like a calculator. I know what it all is. And I don't know if having alcohol has similarities to that. You know, I know AA's. Well,
it's interesting.
Yeah, tell me.
It's interesting because I wouldn't call it a full-blown eating disorder. I was never anorexic, but I had incredible self-discipline when I was an active alcoholic. And this is why this idea that addictions have something to do with willpower is total BS. I had more willpower than anyone. I was totally self-disciplined. So I was more of an exercise addict, and I would also reduce my food, but addicted to sugar at the same time. So I ate so much sugar. It was insane. And then I would run for like 20 miles, you know? And so I would say more exercise addiction. And I remember being very thin, but of course society told me I looked amazing, right? And I was probably 115 pounds at 5'5", whereas now I'm like 125, 127, you know? So, and I'm thin now.
Yeah.
So I was very, very thin, and I kept it that way. I didn't want to pinch an inch. And I remember one of the things that happened when I got into recovery, because these addictions were comorbid, right?
Did you at all reduce food so that you could take in the calories of the alcohol and not gain weight? Because I had a female addict that did that type of thing.
Not consciously, but okay. I remember I would definitely use alcohol instead of food. Like I wouldn't eat and I would drink instead, kind of thing.
Yeah. You know? I purged through exercise because I'm so afraid to vomit.
Right. And you know what's interesting, Dr. Sherry, is I used to vomit all the time when I drank. Like throwing up was a normal occurrence for me. Since I gave up alcohol, let's touch wood when I say this, since I gave up alcohol in 2010, I have not vomited once.
Oh my God. I didn't vomit for 25 years. And my daughter went to a Great Wolf Lodge and came back with norovirus. And I was crying and shaking. And my 18-year-old's like, oh my God, mom, like you're such a baby. But I actually I had a very traumatizing experience with vomit. It didn't come out of nowhere. I had gotten either a flu or food poisoning, and I was vomiting so violently that I was also aspirating it into my lungs. And I did feel like I was going to die, and I was only in third grade. So they took me to a hospital, actually, and they packed me in ice. I had a very high fever, and they put something in my veins and something up my to make me stop.
Another region. Yeah.
Another region down south to make me stop vomiting. And it was just, I think it just imprinted my brain. So like I never did, but I if I ate food, I would immediately feel fat. And then that made me feel icky. So you were 115. I got down to 82.
Yes. Yeah. I was not anything like that.
And I would count my bones and I would do all of this stuff, but I don't ever encourage this as like a solution, but at that time, I think if I didn't have something that controlled my emotions the way that the food did, I like projected out onto food certain things. I don't know that I would have made it through that time of my life. Like, I think addictions have their purpose. We want to heal from them, but it's like, what if you didn't have the alcohol? And I'm not condoning it, but just trying to look at it from a different, more rebellious phase. Like, you needed relief to survive.
Yeah, exactly.
Many of us, you know, have very dark thoughts as we are going in those years. And then in the teenage years, I was 16, you were 16. We have the prefrontal cortex is shut down developmentally. That's rational thought. And then we have increased dopamine, which is I'm invincible. We can do things from 15 to 21. I could never be anorexic today. I would never have that kind of self-control today. But in some way, I always try to find what's the gift for a very bad thing that took my body 7 years to recover from, literally 7 years to recover from the damage of being that thin. I don't know what would have gotten me through. I needed to be out of my body that was just in such constant stress. And it took me right out of my body. Like, I'm not talking about I'm having an outer body experience. I'm saying I felt just numbed out to things. I felt like just I was so zoned in on food that I didn't have to think about my mom, all the cut downs, whereas you were getting
realities too painful.
Too painful.
When you grow up in a home like that, when you have parents who treat you like that.
You're getting good grades. I'm getting horrible grades.
Right.
I didn't give a fuck. Yeah. I was like, you don't care about me? I don't care about me, but I'm going to be thin, you know? So it's just kind of remarkable that I got through that time. And I feel like, Laura, if you look back, can you see that? Obviously, you don't want to be an addict. I'm not condoning, but can you see that in some way it kind of helped you?
Yeah, I think it did give me that much needed relief that you talk about because the body was in such a state of hijack. And it's an example of how our childhood strategies for coping that can actually, maybe they don't work well, but they do keep us alive and all of that stuff, you know? And then as we get older, they become very maladaptive. And that's what happened with my drinking. Something that gave me some relief, albeit with a lot of consequences when I was younger. As I got older, as I had children, you know, then it became extremely maladaptive. And there were guardrails that kind of mitigated my addiction. So I wasn't always in active addiction. It was something that kind of came and went through my life, depending on how much emotional
stress,
pain I was in. Yeah. So with my first daughter, I actually was in a pretty good place when she came along. And I really, you know, enjoyed the time with her as a new mom and all that stuff. So I barely drank at all. I didn't drink during my pregnancies. I think that the morning sickness helped with that, you know.
Yeah.
But by the time my second one came along, I was in deep emotional pain because of my husband's neglect, because of his family's toxicity compounded onto mine. His mother hated me, made my life a living hell, and he was very enmeshed with her. So you can imagine how much I was dealing with on top of being a young mom.
I mean, you really repeated your own father's neglect of you and your own mother's jealousy and hatred of you. You just replicated. I did the same thing.
So you have it coming from both sides. It's intolerable. It becomes intolerable.
Yeah.
So by the time my second one came along, I went back into the addiction and she did not get the bonding that my first one got, which is very unfair, but that's the way it played out. And so that active addiction continued until she was about 6 years old. And that's when I got divorced. That's when I faced the fact that I was in an active addiction, that I couldn't stop on my own. That's when I went into recovery. That was 2010 and I haven't drank since.
What is recovery like? I think every addict is different. And I've treated addicts that had very little family trauma, like it was just sort of in their blood, right? But when there's family trauma, you know, and because I worked at Salvation Army, I know all the steps and the fourth step and, you know, all of that stuff. But I did read a book called A Million Little Pieces, and I read it years ago.
Yeah, I know it.
Loved that book. And I was so upset that he got called out when it was really a publishing mistake, not a him mistake. And I'm glad Oprah apologized to him. I think he deserved it. But his whole theory was hold on, remember? And some guy tattooed hold on to his arms where he would inject heroin, because his whole philosophy was if you can just hold on to the moment where you're emotionally unregulated and just not do your thing, you know, then you can be around alcohol. You don't have to be a sober or a normie or a recoverer. Like he didn't like that. He freed himself from that. And I've worked in both, and I think they both work, but we never learned to hold on to ourselves as children in toxic families because no one held on to us. We never had the trust. We had the mistrust. And that's pre-verbal and precognitive. It's not pre-feeling. And so it's really hard to emotionally regulate when you never had a home base. You never had that warm, safe space where your mother actually created this space to have you held in the world and loved through the world in that space, right? So when you're recovering, how much did your family dynamics come up? It's like, oh my God, like, yes, yes. What, like, tell us about that.
Unfortunately, in the 12-step program, it doesn't come up a lot. And that's one of my issues with the 12-step program. I'm incredibly grateful to it because at the time, I just needed that to get out of the grave that I was in, you know, just to pull myself out of that addiction. I just needed to be told what to do and do it, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is very organized, but it's very self-blaming.
Yes, it's and very self-blaming.
And I don't love that about, and I think that's why I loved that other guy's book, A Million Little Pieces, because it wasn't so self-blaming. It was more like, because he hated his family. See, I think that's his mom drove him to fury. I think that's why I related. So I'm loving that you're saying that, Laura, because this isn't about bashing any one program. Like they all have their place. But I think that we need to grow from more than just AA and look at like, not just how did you mess everything up in your life, because you've already been told that your entire life, which kind of drove you there. I found that so ironic. And I love that, you know, you see that as well and that you're saying that out loud, because I think new things need to come into practice because so many of us ended up in that place from being abused. So when did your family start coming into it for you?
Well, I was very active in the 12-step program for a year, and I needed to be. And in my opinion, when that program was developed back in the 30s, I don't think it was meant to be your entire life. I think you were meant to go through those steps and then get on with your life, you know, but
people, I agree.
They want to stay in that for the rest of their lives, keep calling themselves alcoholics.
Yes.
And that's not what I wanted to do. So as a very growth oriented person, I was ready to move on to the next, you know, what's next after this. And so I did a year full on. And then the second year, I kind of hung out in the rooms, but I wasn't really devoted to it. Another thing to let women know is it's not really safe for women in those rooms.
It is
you
not.
You have to be very careful. It is.
Yes.
There's no checks and balances
no.
as far as harassment goes. If you're a pretty woman in those rooms, you watch your back, you stay with the women, get your boundaries up, don't talk to men, you know, and the good men won't talk to you. Like I noticed
in those rooms, true.
The good men wouldn't talk to me. Mm-mm. And that's how it should be.
Well, when I worked at Salvation Army, they don't mix. It's all men on one side, all women on another. For my PhD, I had to go attend those meetings. No one warned me about that. And I didn't feel safe. Another thing is that I want to curtail on something you said is there was a guy there 30 years sober and he's like, hi, I'm Dave. I don't know if that's his name, but I'm an alcoholic. And like spiritually, I think I am is like the most important statement we can make in this world.
Yes.
And so I love that you are saying there is life outside of AA and beyond AA for those people who are interested in that type of search. How did you find your way through, and how did it bring you to your family trauma?
Well, so I needed to go through that. One of the tenets of the 12-step program is you have to be completely honest with yourself. And I had never done that. Not even literally in my diaries would I be totally honest with myself. I was so covered in shame and lies and hiding and all of that stuff. So that was a huge gift to me, to learn how to be really honest with myself, to get some humility, all of that stuff. Because even though I had self-loathing and low self-worth, I didn't have humility. Humility mm-hmm. is different.
It is.
Humility comes from kind of a higher sense of self, right?
Yeah, it's more grown.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I gained those things, very grateful for those, and then moved on. And as I moved on, I started to understand how my family played into it. And it was just because my mind had been cleared. My mind had been cleared of the alcohol, so I was no longer just treading water. I was actually like starting to thrive and starting to notice the absolute ridiculousness that was going on in my family and how I was expected to tolerate things that were just complete nonsense, you know, mm-hmm. like they're
That makes
ridiculous.
So much sense. It makes so much sense because whether it's an eating disorder or alcohol, it does fog you out. You get divorced from reality, like you had said, it's too painful. But at some point, we have to drop back in, right? And I think like just the clarity that you have and what it did to allow you to fully heal and look at, I've got to fix the core of myself if I'm ever really going to be healed for a long term, never go back to addiction, instead of like just basing it all on willpower. I think that's why there's so much relapse, is because, first of all, it's a $30 billion program is relapse. They kind of need you or expect you to fail. $30 billion program is relapse. And then there's this, well, relapse is a part of recovery. Well, yes, if it's only based on willpower. I think when we can, or we find the courage or the humility to be honest with ourselves about our parents, about other siblings we may have had, about whatever took us so low that we had to escape reality, is where long-term healing occurs, where you can literally not even worry about sober or not sober, relapse. It's like not even a thing anymore, because you recognize, like, I need to do the basement work. I need to go in and I really need to unpack the stuff that's in my basement. I need to move out everything that's not mine. I need to put my core wounds together and just know myself. And that's what I love about your journey, is that there'd be no fear of addiction for you because you know what's in every drawer of your damn basement. You know what, you know your emotional location. You don't lose track of it anymore. You're not being poisoned by the parents. You no longer need the substance. Now you can fall into this human being that you are with knowledge and self-trust, right? And it feels like that is where you are. And it's so, Laura, it's so inspiring knowing that less than 1% of people recover, because this work that you did in this book is so scary to people. To admit that their parents were abusive is so scary to people because they're probably still connected and feel the need. They weren't ever allowed to separate and individuate. And we have to, but it keeps them drinking. It keeps them addicted. It keeps them stuck to the poison that they have to escape from. You escaped. How did you do that? We have 15 minutes. It must have went so fast. How would you say that you escaped? And what advice would you give anybody who's in your position on getting out of the family or setting boundaries or getting sober? What are your key things that you want us to know?
I would say one of the controversial things about the 12-step program is the leaning on a higher power, the God part. And I have to be honest and say that was a big part of it for me, mm-hmm. learning to lean on something bigger than me, learning to surrender, because I was raised in an atheist home. So like my parents were God, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so learning to meet the real God and my version of the real God, and to surrender to that, to learn the meaning of surrender, to learn that it's not all up to me. I don't have control over everything. That was a really big part of it. Another part of it was community. So if I wanted a drink, I remember the first time after I got sober when I really wanted a drink, And I was lucky to be living in Ontario, Canada, because the booze is not available all the time.
Oh, wow.
It was only available in certain government-run shops until 10 o'clock at night.
Wow, thank
and
God.
And so like around 9, I got the craving and I called someone in the program who I knew was a chatty Kathy. And I said, she'll just talk for an hour. I know she will. And so I called her and she just talked. And at 11 o'clock, I'm like, it's closed. I'm safe. And I put the phone down. And so I did have these guardrails around me, even with where I was born, that kind of, you know, kept me in check sometimes.
Yeah, amazing.
And then having the children, you know, you look at the children and you say, like, I don't want to keep doing what I've been doing. I'm going to give them something better.
Yeah.
So I had things in my own life that really helped me with that. And it wasn't willpower. It was never willpower. Mm-hmm. It was about, like what you said earlier, the hold on thing, you know, the checking your emotions. What am I feeling that's making me want to have a drink and deal with that instead? Mm-hmm. And that still is the thing. And that's what I've told my children too, that, you know, if you feel like you want to drink, like, or if, why, like what's going on? Mm-hmm. Often it's just that you're not dealing with an emotion that needs to be processed.
Yeah. I always say that our emotions are like children that need the soothing and the nurturing that we didn't get. And I always feel like my more reactive emotions are my inner child just looking for some kind of safe space or soothing. And it's taken a lot of work on my end to kind of develop the three strong aspects of myself. And I write about it in the book, as you read, there's little Sherry, present day and future Sherry. And we have conference calls, you know, because there's times that little Sherry just is upset. And I can sense that I'm having a hard time regulating my emotional state or whatever's going on because there's some sort of a trigger. But I really get into a journal. You know, I never in my life had the intention to write a book ever. It was never an intent. In fact, a patient was a songwriter and he's like, songs are not hard to write. And I give my patients a lot of homework. And so he's like, I'm giving you homework today. And I'm like, okay, we're going to be collaborative. So my very first book ended up being all poetry, and I'd never written poetry in my life. And that is a self-published book. But one of the key things that helps me heal or really understand my emotional location is actually writing with my hands, not typing, but really getting with paper and pen. And why am I so upset? It organizes my thoughts. It distracts my left brain from overthinking with our task of writing. And then my right brain, where I'm far more spiritual or able to see a bigger picture, where I can be more of the future Sherry, then I can kind of coach who I am today to coach her, the one who is feeling really broken. And I know not everyone is a writer, but I just want to encourage everyone listening, like, you don't have to be a writer, but write. You know, as an author, and I don't know if your brain does this, Laura, but my brain does things with words. So I think I've written myself back into existence. If I had believed the verbal narrative about me that was told that I was crazy, I was unwell, I was unstable, I was out of control, if I'd believed that, I wouldn't be here interviewing today. And I had a journal. And I feel like I had to counter that narrative. I wrote myself back into existence without really knowing it all the time. So write, W-R-I-T-E and R-I-G-H-T. You can write or write yourself back into existence. I had to keep myself writing to head in the right direction, right? Toward me, toward my ability to manage my life. I love that we have guardrails. I too believe I'm very much a universe girl. I love the laws of attraction. I love science. Anymore, something has to be proven to me. I was not raised in a religious family. The two times I did go to church, it scared the shit out of me. I was afraid of the devil. No one was very nice. And God felt like a mean man with a checklist. I already had that at home. I had the checklist every day of what a shit kid I was. So I just felt so scared of that. It didn't resonate. But this is embarrassing in a way, but I started believing in God from Yoda on The Empire Strikes Back. Like, he was green and he was squishy and I loved stuffed animals. I never liked dolls. I think because I was a little girl and I didn't like dolls. I liked stuffed animals. And I had a whole little world that I could escape into that was fantasy based with stuffed animals as a little girl, and I felt safe there. But there are so many ways to heal. I do think spirituality is a huge part of it. Even if we look at Maslow, hierarchy of needs, spiritual's at the top. You know, we have to get our physical needs met. We work up the triangle. But I think writing, communicating however you can, whether that's through prayer or for me, I kind of really feel connected when I'm moving my body. Movement is medicine for me. I think if you have an urge to drink, you could go move your body even and just replace it with something else that's going to get the emotion or the craving moving through your system. When I am stressed and I'm not feeling a sense of hunger, I try to just move my body so that I will end up provoking that feeling of hunger. And I just walk gently or I just move because I feel like so many of us don't know the hows of getting to the next place, you know? And I love your guardrails, what you did. You made a call. You knew you could call this person. She would talk your ear off and then it would get you past a certain time where then you wouldn't feel the permission. And that's what I love about getting beyond something just like AA or beyond like CBT, you know, with cognitive behavioral therapy. It works. It's good in the beginning. But if you really want to heal, you have to sing over your bones to the dismembered pieces of you that you have forgotten down in the basement that are forever injured. And you don't go there to fix them. You just sing over them. You love over them. They're always going to be injured. Unless we all go out and get lobotomies, we're going to have our memory associated with the emotion that goes with it. We have the amygdala and the hippocampal areas. Just how it works. And I feel like if we can embrace that healing is a forever journey, then we're going to be forever growing. And we don't have to worry about failure. Did I pass the test? Am I going backward because I had a bad day? There's no such thing. You know, don't you agree?
I'm glad you said that because I was just thinking exactly the same thing. And I wanted us to mention it, that where you are is where you are. Like, don't feel like you should be doing better or you should be further along. If you can't ask for help, I had ways of asking for help that were nonverbal because I couldn't do it. And that's okay. Like at the time, I remember needing help and instead like going to a meeting and feeling like I needed help. And instead of asking, when someone asked how I was doing, I just said, I'm not very good. And I didn't put on makeup and I didn't do my hair. Those were my ways of asking for help. So you do what you can. You can't force yourself to be at a point that you're not at yet. You have to give yourself a ton of grace because you're overcoming a lifetime of conditioning and it's not going to happen overnight. You have to treat yourself like the child that never got the care, right?
You really do. Oh my gosh, we're going to end on that because that's such a superpower way to end. And you stated it so elegantly and so clearly. And I know that the listeners are going to really appreciate that. There is the pass-fail, the test around every corner that you never got to study for. It doesn't exist anymore. It's more round healing than linear, I think is what I'm taking from what you're saying. It's also how I believe. I'm not looking for it to be linear. There's a start, but there's really no finish. There's only growth. I feel like the more we heal, the more we grow. And if we go backward, then we need more growth. And looking at growth is a really positive, beautiful, self-actualizing thing. Growth for me makes me articulate. And I feel like to be articulate is a superpower because it is about being clear about yourself. Then you can really authentically represent yourself in the world. And you know your no's and you know your yeses with more clarity. And then also, if you don't know you don't know. And you can say, I don't know. I really need to think about that. But to get out of self-judgment, in your healing process, remember your parents aren't judging this one, right? It's like they're not in your life anymore. They're not in the seat. I mean, they're probably judging you from the sidelines, throwing tomatoes at you because I get those too. But your process is private. And I think that things that are quiet are very powerful. And, you know, Laura, just there's so many things that I love about you. But if I could say that there's just this one thing about you that just stands out to me, it's just how poised and elegant you are. And your energy really exudes that. And that is a testament to how much you've healed. And so when people watch this, they're going to see you and they're going to see what I see. And it's inspiring, you know, to see such beautiful qualities in somebody who came from something so hard. And I just really appreciate you coming on my show. And you guys, please, it's not your fault. It's just so true. Please go get her book. And then my book's out too. This girl, she's here. She's out in the world. Laura endorsed it. And we'll put all these in the links. And anytime you see a summit from Laura, please join these summits. She is a superhero Wonder Woman, and the team of speakers that she gathers are just unbelievable. And I am so honored every time I get asked to join. I will join for the rest of my life if she will have me. And this is a community. Laura and I really adore each other, and we work together. We don't have to compete. There's no competition. There's just healing together, and we do need each other. We're all used to being very isolated and healing alone and healing lonely, and we don't need to do that anymore. And that is why we have people like Laura on my show. So, my brave hearts, thank you so much for joining Laura and I today. We love you. We wish you well. And we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks.
Well, brave hearts, that concludes our amazing Sherapy session for the day. Please sign up on my email list at drsherrycampbell.com so that you can be in touch with me and see what's going on in terms of what I'm offering soon, what books are coming out, etc. Talk to you in a couple of weeks.